Say What? Say What radio show. With no agenda. It's always a surprise. But if we're not having fun, we're doing something wrong.
Welcome to the Say What Show. This is being recorded on March 20th, 2026. My name is Nancy Hopkins, and this is another chapter 13, to be exact, on the woohoo reality that we'll eventually make into a book. I want to start with the last time we were here, which is when I played a clip from a show with Ani Avedisian and myself on the Spear of Destiny. This was the tip of a staff, supposed to be a ceremonial Jewish talisman. Now, a talisman can actually be anything that is believed to possess magical powers or properties that bring good fortune, protection, or simply power to its owner. The spear has a history from being used at the crucifixion of Jesus to a symbol for the Nazis and Adolf Hitler. If the history is accurate, this talisman is entwined in the history of the world. Let me tell you why. While I doubt the history is completely accurate, I do think it is critical to understand the evolution of humanity. I started with internet radio back in 2013, and it was introduced to hundreds of people with I was introduced to hundreds of people with alternative views on what reality is. This has also opened up connections to websites and books with a different view than the prevailing concept of what is real. From geopolitical stories to spiritual stories that made me question history to science and religion. And the alternative narratives seemed unending. Many people went through the same process, and some became unhinged, in my opinion, and many just gave up trying to sort it all out. As crazy as I sometimes sound, I really am not unhinged. And I am still sorting through the unending stories from the internet. I think what saved me is I had this knowing it all might be true and it all might not be true. I suspect that attitude started with the lies associated with President Kennedy's assassination when I was 15. It made me distrust essentially everything. I began to think in terms of stories until they are proven likely true. Eventually, I thought of the stories as true or not true, depending upon which timeline we were on. And yes, some of the stories were about the existence of timelines, and some of them were being told by certified, quote, scientists. But it was not the articles and books and podcasts that made me begin to think in terms of timelines. It was my own observations and experiences. A very simple example is a friend who would relate stories of us doing this, that, or the other thing and going somewhere that I had no memory of at all. Thankfully, another friend of mine would hear the same stories, and she was included in them, and also seemed to have no memory of them. And these were often detailed stories. Knowing there may be alternative timelines allowed us to conclude our mutual friend was on a slightly different timeline than we were on. This became apparent when the Mandela effect began to spread all over the internet. Now, the Mandela effect is a phenomenon where a large group of people share a false memory, according to what's accepted now, of an event, detail, or cultural artifact, often misremembering facts about pop culture, brand logos, or history. It was coined by Fiona Broom regarding the mistaken belief that Nelson Mandela died in prison in the 1980s. I have a clear memory of that causing me confusion when I heard Mandela had been elected president of South Africa. I'm going, he's dead. What the heck is happening? But I didn't give it much thought. It didn't make any sense to me, but I thought, well, maybe I misremember him. Well, most of the conflicts in memory dealt with spelling in the Mandela effect, spelling and products I am not familiar with. A large number of noted change I definitely had an opinion on. Many of them, I remember them. Once aware of the phenomena, I began noticing other Mandela type changes. And these weren't being reported on. These were what I remember. So let's just go a couple through three of these. Let's do three. I told you the story about Luke Short and Tombstone, Arizona, and that Short had been killed by John Heath in a barroom. Okay. Then a retired Air Force colonel says to me, you know, I apologize. It was an unfair gunfight. Now, I don't know what caused him to say that or to remember that or to know that, but he said it. When I was in Tombstone a couple of weeks before this, when I began to remember, I mean, in detail, about Luke Short, it was because I was walking around basically in the same environment, 1870s, that he had lived in Tombstone. It still kept the same way. And I kept kind of reverting back to his memory and then seeing things that didn't fit that memory. Now, I mentioned that I had a, Arkansas Native American who was with me, whose people believed in reincarnation, and she talked me through it. I was very grateful to her, but she was probably put there so that I had somebody to talk me through what I was going through. So I got transfixed in front of a plexiglass description of a man named John Heath, who had been considered an outlaw cowboy. They were going around and stealing everybody's cows. And he went down to Mexico, and when he came back, he ended up being with a group of people that robbed the Bisbee, a local town, their bank. Now, he wasn't part of it, and he had an alibi. But the gang did do it. The townspeople didn't care because it was Heath that was the head of the gang, and they lynched him. I told you all this before. And then I told you I went to, I think I told you, maybe I didn't even mention this at the time, but when we were leaving Tombstone, there's a place called Boot Hill. And Boot Hill is a graveyard, basically, but doesn't have too many things in it, but it's a graveyard. I don't even know how many, because by the time we got there, I was exhausted. My mind was all befuddled. I'm kind of walking around with my reality and then being in somebody else's reality. So I'm walking along, and I've got a Polaroid camera with me. And all of a sudden, I see a tombstone. Now, I also told you that he had killed somebody there. Charlie Smith? Charlie Stone, I think. But regardless, I Charlie. And I took a picture of it. It's a beautiful picture. It's the tombstone, and right behind it is the setting sun. You can see the sky. It's going dusk. So for years I had this photograph, and I looked at it numerous times. I mean, at least a dozen times over the years. It always said Charlie. Well, when the Mandela effect started up, I started thinking in terms of stories. And I thought to myself, I know that Luke Short lived and died in Tombstone. There's a lot of background about him being in Tombstone, but I've never heard of him actually dying there. And it was sort of like a, whoa, did I miss something? And by this time, we got the internet. So I Googled his name, and there's a whole story about his life after li leaving Tombstone. Well, it kind of really perplexed me because it was like this fact that I had carried with me for years was all of a sudden maybe not true. But thankfully, I already understood the Mandela. It's sort of as best as one person can. So I look up because of that. I look up, Tombstone, I mean Boot Hill. I looked up the images, pictures, and sure enough, the same tombstone that I had a photograph of in my hand. It said Charlie Stone Smith. And it was so strange because that photo, I mean, the exact same tombstone, but it n no longer said Charlie. It said John Heath. And it wasn't like, some of these things are just wooden crosses. No, this was a tombstone. And everything was identical except the name. And now it says John Heath, the guy that supposedly killed Luke Short, not the guy that Luke Short apparently killed. So I'm thinking about it, and I'm going, if I had known, I mean, I took this picture 2 weeks before. My brain was a little muddled, but I mean, it's a Polaroid. I saw the picture. I looked at it a number of times. So I was with the Air Force colonel, and we're talking about John Heath. Why wouldn't I have remembered that that said John Heath? Why would it have never come into my thought process? Because I thought it said Charlie. So if there's one Mandela effect happening regarding Tombstone, I thought, it's very likely that my story is true, but on a different timeline than what I'm on now. Okay. And remember, I had switched timelines because of being asked by my guides to do so. And that was back in, December of 2000. So I know that I may, well, I mean, I never questioned the fact when they asked me, and I didn't know that much about timelines, if I even knew anything. But I didn't question it. I just, okay, this is what you want me to do. All right. I'd gotten very used to using their guidance. So I decided in my mind, well, the story I'm going to go with is the one that I knew before I switched timelines. The fact it might be different on the timeline I'm on now doesn't really matter one way or the other. The rest of the story about John Heath, does it matter? Well, yeah, it does matter. it set up a whole series of thoughts in my head about what is my reality. Now, another example of this Mandela effect in my own life that I could perceive. In 2016, when I decided that maybe I should learn how to produce a radio program for a lot of reasons, and Walt Silver was working with me, he was extremely knowledgeable about computers. And I'm talking to him, and I said, I said, I want to do this, but I have a feeling that there's going to be a computer program where you don't need the sound mixer. Now, the sound mixer was a piece of hard equipment that you had to have. You take the signal that you're recording and you'd put it in there, and then from there, you would put it on an internet app, they'd call them now, to be broadcast over the internet. But in the 2.5 years I'd been working on radio, the producers always seemed to be having a problem with the mixer. And I didn't think I wanted another device to control me. And I said, I think there's some kind of a computer program out there that will absolutely take out the mixer need. We won't need the mixer. And I said to Walt, can you look for it? And he said, Nancy, that doesn't exist. And I said, I know you've told me this, and JP's told me this, and all these other people have said, no, it doesn't exist. I'm telling you, I think it exists. I said, just go out there and look, because I really wouldn't know what to ask for or what to look for. Just go out there and see if you can find it. Oh, all right. Well, 20 minutes later, he comes back to me and he said, by God, you're right. There is such a thing. And not only that, but it's free. So he downloaded it into my computer, and off we go. But I got interested in it, and I said, why is it that he could find it in 20 minutes, but everybody that was anybody in this business said, no, it doesn't exist? So I did a research into the company and the product itself, and found out that it had been made in Czechoslovakia, I think it was, and had been out for 10 years. And I looked at it and I went, is this another Mandela thing? Because if you change a timeline, do you change the past? Well, yeah, that would make sense. You're jumping on a timeline that's already got a whole history. Not the history of the one you were on, but a new one. So I began to think in terms of timelines having their own unique history, each one of them. Okay, so another example of Mandela in my life. Well, let me think when this was. I'm not even sure when it was. It was prior to 2013, I think. Anyway, it doesn't really matter. I was writing Cosmic Reality book, and I got it finished. So I decide, okay, I'm going to print it out, and then I'm going to go back and I'm going to read through it and make sure everything is okay. But before I did that, I said, well, let me just do it before I print it and make sure everything's okay. So I start looking at it and I'm reading it and I'm not reading every word, but I'm, going through the consecutive subjects to see does this all make sense. And I come across the 100th monkey problem. Now, this was up in the beginning of the book, and it's a situation that occurred that I remember very vividly of Somebody from Great Britain. It was a scientific group from Great Britain, and then there was a scientific group from Japan. At the same time, they actually went to neighboring islands unknown by themselves to study the same monkey. And the one that the Great Britain people were looking at, the monkeys were not particularly afraid of humans. And they would watch the humans. Well, in Great Britain, they ate potatoes. And they would wash the potatoes and cook them up and everything. Well, pretty soon you saw monkeys washing potatoes because there was potatoes on that particular island, washing them. And then they got interested in it, so they started, looking at it. And it was a small group comparatively. They were able to, I mean, there was over 100 monkeys, quite a lot more than that. But they started watching very carefully and take, they were scientists, and they were taking notes on how many of these monkeys are actually all of a sudden doing this. So they get to the 100th monkey, and all of a sudden, every monkey on the island was washing their potatoes before they ate them. They weren't cooking them, they were making them raw, but washing the potato. So, in the report that they had, there was a lot of other things in that report, but they also reported this crazy thing about 100th monkey syndrome, it began to be called. So they publish it. Well, the Japanese read that article. They're stunned. Absolutely stunned, because they were on another island, like I said, neighboring island, same monkeys. And on the same date, every monkey on that island all of a sudden had begun to wash the potatoes. And they had no idea why. They're just all of a sudden just started washing potatoes. Now, what was the difference? Well, this was Japanese. They ate rice. They didn't eat potatoes. So they didn't learn it from the Japanese scientists. And this concept of the 100th monkey syndrome was talked about. I mean, this is in free press. It's like, what is this all about? What does this mean? Is there some mind connection beyond what we understand? I mean, it was a real big impact on science. So I had written about it in the book Cosmic Reality. Then just before I was working on it, I hadn't finished it, but I was working on it. I see this article on the internet about somebody who, this girl, who was absolutely disputing that the 100th monkey syndrome ever happened. So I start reading it and I'm going, I know it happened. But her facts as to telling why it did not happen were pretty compelling. Pretty compelling. So I said, instead of having something in the book that I know could be of contention because of this article, I'm just going to take it out. It's not real critical in my mind. It wasn't real critical to the overall book, Cosmic Reality. So I take it out. I do the editing to get everything lined up right and correct. And I go to bed. And I get up in the morning and I get an email from Jean Rockefeller, this messenger from whoever. And she said, Jack, who was her horse, that was not just a horse, he was a watcher, is a watcher, and provided us with a lot of, through Jean, she was telepathically connected. She tells, she was a hygienist, dentist hygienist. And one day at work, all of a sudden, she gets this voice in her head, Jean, this is Jack. And she's like, oh my God, I'm losing my mind. Because she had never experienced this before. And he proceeds to tell her that he needs her to start an internet website so that he can pass out some information. Well, she thought she was going Looney Tunes and she really fought it, but eventually she said, no, this is real. And so she began working very closely with Jack. She did what he wanted, made him a website, and started putting out some very, very, very deep and meaningful and revealing articles. And we became friends because I went to that website. So she writes me and she says, Jack says, whatever you took out of that book last night, you have got to put back in. And I'm going like, what did I take out? And initially I couldn't remember. And I said, oh, it's a 100th monkey story. So I by that time I was real. Jack said something to me. I paid attention. So I reconsidered what the book was saying, and I realized that the story about the 100th monkey shouldn't have been in the front. It should have been in the back. Now all of this book, and it's got a lot of information in it. I wrote in 3 months because over 10 years, more than 10 years, I had taken notes. And these notes, I just decided when I was going to write the book to just go down and follow the notes and see what happens. And I never made a change. I stayed with those notes. I just expanded on them. The order of them seemed right. I didn't question it, except on this one issue. So I put the story at the end of the book instead of the beginning of the book. And then I started learning about the Mandela effect and stuff, and I thought, oh, I get it. She's on this timeline. And that did not happen on this timeline. It happened on the old timeline. So it was these continual, I'm only giving you three of them, these continual, kind of pokes at me that, yes, that timeline shift was real. And the Mandela effect is real because you didn't jump alone. You know the story. We made you aware of the story. You're the storyteller. But a lot of other people did the same thing. So they have memories up until 2000 that is different than the memories from a lot of people that are on the 2000, after 2000 on the timeline you're on. And that these were awakening or awakened people that made the timeline jump. Bottom line here, the story about Mandela's effect, I accept as true, until proven differently. Now, we're talking about the sphere of destiny. I know I haven't mentioned it, but I'm trying to give you a background in why I believe that it's so critical to understand it. I'm going to tell you a story that is about remote viewing. Because I've cautioned people in doing remote viewing that once I understood timelines, that you have to be careful that you get on the right timeline. It's not just a matter of getting on the going back into time to a specific time. Is be on the same timeline that you want to look at. And other people have a lot of ways of doing this and thinking about it and talking about it. I'm just telling you what my experience tells me it is. Remote view, time doesn't exist. Timelines exist in that a consensus of belief. Okay? But time itself is not some thing you can measure, you can make believe you're measuring it, but it's dependent on place and space. Okay, and this is science. So the space we're talking about is you. Me. In that we are the core because we're traveling on a planet that is moving breakneck speed. I don't know how many thousands of miles an hour, but it changes all the time. And every time you are doing this, you're actually the energies that you're associating with as you move to different places is different. And so it affects you differently. That's why time is not measurable. But in essence, the concept of timelines is. So I'm on a Zoom Skype call at the time with Michael Henry Dunn, who had been, well, he's the guy that got me put together the Radio 5G show, talking about the dangers of telecommunications and Wi-Fi and all of the network of stuff that was all around us. He said, you know, we need to put a podcast. A guy by the name of Mark Steele was out there, and he's from England. And Mark lived in a town that was right next to the town that was one of three cities that was going to put in the 5G first in Great Britain. He's driving down the street and he sees them working on this new telephone poles, and they're putting something on the poles, and he looks at it and he goes, whoa, that's not for telecommunications. That's a weapon system. Because his job was to develop electromagnetic weapons and defense things, things you can do to defend yourself against it. But also offensively, you gotta know what's possible. And he knew immediately that that was, you know, part of a 5G system. So he proceeds to investigate. He even went to the town and said, you know what you've got up there? He was not a conspiracy guy up until this point. And the more he learned, and the fact that he was arrested for treason or something twice went before a judge, and twice the judge said to the town, you listen to him. Because he had all these credentials, he had patents. He's very well known in his profession. So he had started to kind of like ring the bell of danger here. They're putting 5G out there, and 5G is designed to disrupt people's brains and their bioelectromagnetic fields, and it's a very dangerous weapon. I actually interviewed him very early in the game because my friend Michael said, we got to talk to this guy, set up a new radio show. And so I did. We talked to Mark. Mark was the first person I ever talked to who knew more about this than I did. I was stunned at the amount of information that he brought to the table. So I'm on the Zoom Skype call with Mark, with Michael, and we're just chit-chatting about what the next show is going to be. And all of a sudden he says, what? Hold on. And his wife is telling him that the Cathedral of Notre Dame in France was burning. Well, this really distressed Michael because he had been there to Paris and seen it, been there, been in the church. And she begins to look at the, I don't know what social, Facebook, probably Facebook, because I don't think X was even out there at the time. But she starts to say, read these things as to what is happening on the ground right then and there. And so I'm listening to her in the background and him, asking her questions and stuff. And I said to him, wait a minute, I'm just going to remote view it and see what the heck is happening here. He said, oh, good idea. So I remember I'm cognizant of timelines. So I basically put into my focus this timeline, this time, right now, present time, what's happening. I want to go to Notre Dame. Well, as soon as you focus on it, as soon as I focus on it, I'm there. And I find myself outside of the church, cathedral, with all these people. I mean, people all around me for as far as I could see, and they're all in such incredible emotional distress. These were French people that believed Notre Dame was something very, very special in their culture. And here it is on fire. The impact of their emotion was terrible. And I immediately got out of the remote. And I told Michael about it. He said, "This, oof, these people are so upset." And, he proceeds to tell me, yes, because he, like I say, he's kind of a student of that information. And I said, "Okay, I'm going to go back in." And we had already heard from the internet that the fire was in the back of the church and underneath the steeple. So this time I focused on going back, same timeline, same time, current time, underneath the steeple. And boom, I'm in this room. It's a small room. It's empty. It's a stone room. That's what's the walls are constructed of stone. And there was only one thing in that room. And it was like, I believe it was a table saw. What I was to find out later was that they were doing renovation in the church to begin with. But that was the only thing in this room. It was an empty room. It was this table saw. And I don't remember looking up when I got there. I was just looking around. But all of a sudden, there's an explosion above my head, and I look up. And there probably was a ceiling, I'm not sure, but I was able to go, not look at the ceiling, but to look at the steeple. And the steeple had been, there was an explosion inside the steeple and it was starting to burn. So my next question was, how did this happen? I'm still in the room. How did this happen? And now, instead of seeing the steeple, I'm seeing above the cathedral. In the air. And there is a vehicle, a black vehicle, like a flying vehicle. It wasn't in a saucer shape, it was more like a delta wing, like I'd seen at the University of Massachusetts, to be honest with you. And I see the vehicle, and then I focused on who's inside the vehicle. And I honestly expected to find evil beings of one sort or another. But instead, I saw humanoids, three of them, and they were very pure. Their energy was very good. And it confused me. And so I start to think in a 3D way. And boom, I'm out of the remote. And I'm telling the whole time I was doing this, I was talking out loud. And Michael and his wife heard me tell the story. So, what could, I mean, yeah, something, somebody flying over it started the fire, but it wasn't bad guys, it was good guys. Why would the good guys burn down Notre Dame Cathedral? Well, Michael goes off on this, well, it's on a ley line, and he goes off on this whole story about ley lines and how all of the very powerful cathedrals, churches in England, its banks are all located on these power grids of ley lines. PowerPoints. And he had a lot of information on this. So, we have that conversation. Then we ended the conversation. And I actually told the story on Cosmic Reality Radio Show. Well, a couple of days after the initial thing happened, the initial show list, that I was talking about, there is a video tape. Well, it's not a video tape, it's like still photographs, one after the other, that was taken by a security camera in a resort, big hotel type of thing, slightly across from where Notre Dame was. It's not looking at the church, it's looking at the, well, it was a circle, it was a high, a circle, it was a highway type of thing. And you could see that, the surrounding buildings and everything. It was a snapshot of this right out front of this place. And in the air, okay, above where this city complex thing was. Now, Notre Dame was actually over to the left. Okay, because what happens is that you see these pictures and they're one after the other, only, I don't know, I think it was 12 seconds or something apart. It wasn't very short, but it wasn't very long. And there's this plume of smoke that had come into view and was picked up on the recording. Right above the edge of this, I mean, if it had been any farther to the left of the video, you wouldn't have seen it, but it was there. But towards the left of the pictures is the exact same vehicle that I had told Michael about. Same thing. So now we have a photographic evidence that there was this vehicle right above in the vicinity of mostly almost right above, but the same place that I saw it. That was up there just before the plume of smoke indicating the explosion had happened in the steeple. That would have been good enough to for me to say, "Whoa, that was a real remote view." But a few days after that, on Facebook, a woman or man, I don't know what, posted a photograph of the crowd outside Notre Dame just before the fire happened, and it was of a man and his daughter. It was a very nice picture. And the person that took it was trying to find the dad to be able to, so he'd have this picture because it happened right before the fire started. It would have been, a real keepsake of that day for them. And don't you know that in the picture, the same vehicle is pictured from the ground? Same one. So now there's a second, confirmation that what I saw was real is real. And I wanted you to hear those stories, that story in particular, because it's really fascinating. And also to confirm that when I'm talking about remote viewing, I'm actually remote viewing. I'm seeing this stuff. I'm not making this up. This is not a made-up story in my mind. I am not unhinged. This is a very real phenomenon that people are capable of. So the story starts to, well, first off, it was trending all over the place. And then the conspiracy people get involved in it. And there was a lot of it out there. But again, I'm cognizant and willing to follow the breadcrumbs. And there was this one article that caught my eye and then caught my attention. And it felt like it was a real story. I had no verification if it was real, but it felt like it was real. And they were saying something that a lot of the other alternative, discussions, they were all, it's the bad guys doing this. But whoever was writing this said it was not the bad guys, it was the good guys. Why? Well, Notre Dame is a very, very important talisman, for lack of another word. It's a physical thing that has a tremendous amount of power associated with it. You can access that power if you understand it. The dark side understands it. Because when we're talking about light workers and the waves of people here to help us, and then you have the dark side, I think that this is the same group of people that are associated with demonic powers. And I believe in demons because of my experience in reading the book on demons and getting a physical slap in my face when I started to read it, as if a warning, don't read this. But I pursued it, and I have a let's say in storytelling, I think that that unfortunately is probably real. Demons are real. Negative energy forces are real. The story starts with God and Archangel Lucifer, who decides that he can create like God creates. And it becomes a war between Lucifer and God. But God said to Lucifer, I'll give you the ability to interact with human beings. I so believe in human beings that I don't think you can persuade them to do negative things. I'm paraphrasing, of course. I wasn't there listening. And that's how you kind of set up this concept of Satan and the demons and all these evil entities that are out there that have been in folklore and in history, for that matter, since time began. And what was it that one of the things about the Mandela effect is that the Bible has been changed. I need to tell you that story because that was an amazing story. You remember I told you, no, you didn't, this was a different show. I had an aunt who was a poor Clare's nun. She ended up coming back to Miami and leaving the nunnery. Well, didn't come back to Miami. I mean, I happened to be there in Miami when she, that's where she left the nunnery, Port Clair's, and became a civilian. She started working as a nurse. She and I had to take a trip up to Massachusetts because it was my mother and father's wedding anniversary, 25th wedding anniversary. And everybody in the family had been invited to a surprise party. So off we go. We're driving up to Massachusetts from Miami. And this woman, I can remember as a kid, she was always, everybody was afraid to get in the car with her because she drove so crazy fast. Oh my goodness. And so she's driving with me, and yeah, she was driving fast. I mean, I've gone and done that trip a number of times, but I've never done it as fast as we did it with, I did it with her. And we go up to Massachusetts and we have the party. And meanwhile, I had to leave a job. I got to take some time off to do this. And so it was like, it was kind of opened, I'll come back as soon as I can. So we leave Massachusetts and we're on our way back. And we get to Georgia. And she says to me, "We're going to stop in Atlanta overnight." Now, that was not on my game plan. I wanted to get back to work. I needed the money. And it pissed me off because she has never said anything about this until we were just outside of Atlanta. So, she's driving the car. It's her car. I got nothing much to say about it to stop it. And we go to this, I guess it was a convent. I'm not even sure what it was, attached to some church. And one of her friends was there. And they had a grand old time. I was young. I was pissed off. I didn't get my way. But we stayed there overnight. And then I'm going like, "All right, let's just get back on the road." "No, we got to go see this other guy." And by then I'm like, "What are you doing to me?" So we get back in the car and we get the car parked. Supposedly this is going to be a short trip. Somebody she knows. And I said, "All right." And yeah, well, I didn't say anything. I just was so mad. But we go down Peachtree Lane, I think it was. And this was a beautiful place in Atlanta. It was all lined with mansions. Very, very attractive place. Very rich place. And we pull up in front of this one mansion and we park the car. And there was other cars parked in and around it. And we go inside. And she knocks on the door. No, I think she just walked in the front door of like she owned it. And then there was somebody there, and they put their hand up to their mouth, like, don't talk. But they guide us to the back of this. Well, we had to go through this one door and then kind of a kitchen thing, and then out this other door where there was this small hall. Might have had three, maybe four dozen people in it. And standing up in front of these people was this guy who was probably maybe in his 30s. And I took one look at him. And I got this cold feeling come over my body. It almost paralyzed me. Paralyzed my mind. I just couldn't think and I could hardly walk. I've never been through such a weird state. I am looking at this man and I want to jump and run out of the building. It was almost terror. But my rational mind, the left brain, is going like, "Why? What do you see?" It wasn't anything I saw. It was a feeling. "Yeah, sit down. Stay here." Okay, I'll stay there." And I'm listening now to his words, and it took me a little bit of time, but I realized I was in some kind of like a Baptist revival. These mainly black people were "Amen, amen," and throwing up their hands and doing these things as he would say stuff. And I'm listening to what he's saying, and I didn't see anything threatening or weird about it. It was his opinion of whatever. I don't remember what he was talking about. So my rational mind is listening to this, and And my left brain is going like nothing. I mean, when the left, when, excuse me, right brain, when the left brain comes on, it can drown out your right brain. And your right brain is your psychic side. Let's just think of it that way. And it was like, why am I so afraid of this guy? Everything he's saying seems to be okay. And it just sort of shut down my psychic. You know, I wasn't reacting emotionally to the signaling from the right side of my brain. Okay. So it finally ends, and I'm thinking, oh God, let me get in the car and let's go. Oh no, we have to go to lunch with him. Oh, I gotta go to lunch with this guy that might be something bad. You know, I mean, I'm having this kind of schizophrenic discussion with my left brain, right brain thing. But I got no option. She's got the car, she's got the keys. So we go to lunch. And I sit down with the guy, and when I was right there sitting down and having lunch with him, I didn't feel the emotional response of terror or fear or any of that. And he was very personable, very nice. And the story is he was actually a Catholic priest that began to think in terms different than the traditional accepted way that the Catholics think. So he started his own church. I think they called it was in the evangelistic kind of category. And he begins to focus on me and to present his version of reality and spirituality and who's God. No mention of any devil or that sort of thing, no Lucifer in the story. And he's saying things to me, and I'm very, very good at debate. I was having a terrible time conversing with him because he was citing things that I was not familiar with. This meeting started a whole bizarre 3-day stop in Atlanta. And we were introduced to these evangelistic type of Christians. And it's kind of all blurry from when I went to lunch. I sort of like got, I would say, not necessarily hypnotized, but definitely controlled in some way. So we end up going to this house that belonged to this couple, and they had children. And we went there because we now we're going to go to a Christian revival meeting of very talented professional musicians. And we go down to this theater, and these musicians start to do all these Christian songs, and everybody is like being filled with light and happiness and joy. And wow, it was a ride. Very uplifting, very positive. I didn't have any kind of fear or trepidation or anything. But every once in a while, I would, you know, kind of like, do we want to be here? But then the left side would be taken over by, yes, we do. This is a wonderful place. And part of this group that went there was this lady who's probably my age, 77, at that time. And she just radiated such incredible love and light and knowledge, and she was just, whoa, awe-inspiring. And she invited us to stay with her overnight at her house. And I didn't fight that because I wanted to find some place to sleep. We'd lost the entire day. And she was I've never forgotten her. She really made an impression on me. I kind of would put it into the terms of she's a representative of God and one of God's children, one of God's creations, a representative of whatever God is. So the next day, we have to go back to this house with a couple of the kids and stuff. And we are, it was like a brunch kind of thing. And so we're, I maybe we ate. I don't actually remember eating, but all of a sudden, all these people, we were like in a kitchen, big kitchen with big table. And I'm sitting at the table. And all of a sudden, it was like I realized I was getting ganged up on. All these people seemed to be focused on me. Will you let us pray for you? Will you let us pray for you? Now, I honestly began to get spooked again. And the right side, left side start this conversation. And right side saying, no, I don't want them to pray over me. This is something weird. It's only prayer. How can prayer be bad? Yeah, okay, but I want them to go away. Well, then let them pray over you. Okay, yeah, you can pray. So they start praying. And all of a sudden, I felt this incredible white light come down through my crown chakra into my entire body. And I started speaking. I had no idea what I was saying. I wasn't even thinking. I was just like overcome with this incredible power of this light. And when I started speaking, they start, oh, she's speaking tongues, she's speaking tongues. And I'm going like, what the, I mean, it was just like, I didn't say anything. I couldn't even think about it. All I was recording was what was happening around me. So I honestly, from that moment, I don't know what happened right after that. I don't, because that was the critical thing. And then we get back in the car and we drive to Miami. But I am transformed. I'm somebody that was a different person from the person that, got to Atlanta when I first got there, a different person altogether. And I decided I needed to read the Bible. So I buy a Bible, St. James Version, and I start reading it. I read Genesis. And then going through the whole thing. Well, it didn't take very long before I was absolutely bored. I said, everybody's getting and begotten from this and that. And it was like, I wasn't learning a damn thing from it. It was just like, I don't need to know this. Why would I need to know this? And then I thought about it and I said, the first rule of writing is that you tell your reader what you're going to tell them. You tell them what you want to tell them. And then you tell them what you told them. And I said, okay, so I read Genesis, and I guess it set up or supposedly set up what I'm supposed to know in this book. So what did it say? What am I taking away from Genesis? Well, that God made this wonderful place and put human beings there, and everybody was happy, everybody was. No killing, no hate, no nothing. The animals were friends. Everybody was doing good. And the only stipulation God put on it was don't eat from the tree of knowledge. And then Eve is compelled by the serpent, Satan in the form of a serpent, to eat from the tree of knowledge. And God takes both, and she convinces Adam to do it. And then they both get thrown out of Eden, Garden of Eden. And God says to them, as I remember it, okay, God said, now that you've eaten from the tree of knowledge, you're going to live the tree of life. That's what I remember. So I said, okay, so We got thrown out of the heavenly place at Garden of Eden, and now we're on our own. And now we're encountering all the negative things that we see on earth from being a human being. I don't want to go through this book. I want to go to the conclusion. I'm very impatient. So I went to Genesis, Revelations. And at the time, it was called Revelations with an S. Now it says Revelation. It had an S. And I start reading about that, and I'm going like, this isn't giving me anything. It was horsemen and plagues and end times and not really fun. And I finally get through Revelations, and I get to the last paragraph. Now, what Revelations had been saying was that all of this stuff is happening, but the promised land is, the city of Jerusalem or Jerusalem or something. There was a way out, and you had to choose that way out. And in the last paragraph, it said, for those that are not choosing life, paraphrasing, choosing life, do not reach back. Do not reach back for the thief or the murderer or anybody. Don't reach back. Because if you do, if you try to save them, you're not going to save yourself. And I started thinking about that, and I said, if that's true, this is what this is all about. To get to the promised land of Jerusalem and heaven or whatever it was they were talking about, I have to forsake my fellow man. I can't try to convince them. I can't try to reach out and pull them with me. I can't do anything like that because I'll lose my spot in heaven. And I rejected the Bible. I said, I can't do this. I cannot do this. So, what does this have to do with the spirit of destiny? The reason that I ever became interested in it was when I was in the military. And I had a minor operation, and I had medical leave. So I was in my apartment and wasn't supposed to leave my apartment or do anything. And a friend of mine came over, and she had a stack of books. She said, she worked at the library. She said, we got these as donations, and they all have to do with metaphysical stuff. And I know that you're interested in that sort of subject, so I thought maybe you'd like to see have them. And she laid the books on a cabinet that I had there, and she went off on, doing other things, and I pick up the stack to move it someplace more convenient. And I would say there might have been 10, 12 books in this stack, mostly paperback. I think they were all paperback. I don't know, because the only one I remember is The Spirit of Destiny. And The Spirit of Destiny was in this stack. And as I went to move it, from the middle of the stack came this book that flew across the room by a good 6 feet and landed on the floor. So I put the books back where they had been. And I said, by then I knew enough to pay attention to these things, pay attention to the details. So I go over and I pick the book up. And the title of the book was The Spear of Destiny. And it was written by Trevor Ravenscroft. Now, I don't know when it was published, but this was 1973 that I read it. And Ravenscroft was a British guy who worked like I think he worked for transcribing or writing, helping some other guy. And he details it all out in the book. And the guy is telling the story about the Spear of Destiny. I'm going to tell you, just give you a snapshot of what's in that book. The Spear of Destiny was used by Longinus, supposedly, and pierced the side of Jesus. He did it, in my opinion, out of compassion. He was a Roman soldier, but he was touched by Jesus's power and did a compassionate thing. Stick the spear inside him in order so that his legs wouldn't be broken. Because they normally would keep up a crucified victim for basically days, even after they died. And most of the time they let him suffer. But for some reason, they wanted him buried by sunset, which is a Jewish kind of rule. I'm not sure how they managed to get that agreed to, because it was the Jewish priests really that were pushing the crucifixion. It was the Roman leader at the time that made the decision. Well, he actually gave it to the crowd. He said, I've got this thief here. Do you want him crucified? Or do you want this Jesus character crucified? And they voted for the thief to survive, Jesus to die. So he's on this cross and he's suffering. And Longinus was moved to put the spear in him to keep them from breaking his legs, because you need to be able to use your legs to push up to be able to breathe when you're being crucified. Otherwise, the compression, because your arms are out and you're hanging, it's too much for your lungs to work. So you have to give it a little assistance. Let's put it that way. So it was used at the crucifixion out of compassion. And again, it was supposedly a talisman of power from the Jewish people. Well, the spear goes through history, and again, I don't know that all the history that's available is true, but it ends up in the Habsburg Museum in Vienna, Austria. Now, Adolf Hitler at the time had been born in Germany, Bavaria, I think, and he was in the war, World War I, he had been in the trenches and got exposed to mustard gas, which caused him to go temporarily blind. So he was sort of like not in the army anymore. I think he was released. And he's in Vienna. And he has no way of making any money except to do some like postcards, like drawing pictures on postcards and selling them. So that was what he was doing. And he goes over to the Habsburg Museum and he comes across the Spear of Destiny. According to reports, he had some kind of a mystical experience once he saw it. And this is according to the man that was telling Trevor Ravenscroft the story. But and it wasn't described, what kind of a mystical event, but he had some kind of a mystical event. And then he goes into a, sometime later, he goes into a bookstore with a book that he wants to essentially trade in for another book. So he makes the deal with a bookkeeper. And when the bookkeeper go, well, actually, he looked at it beforehand, and there was all this writing in the book, but still he made the swap, because the writing on the sides of the pages was very, very enlightening to this bookkeeper, bookseller. Now, why? Well, I don't remember his name, Pritzer or something like that. He was associated with a group of kind of like, I don't know what you'd call them, mystics. It was the Thule Society, Thule. And at that time in Europe, in the United States too, there was a lot of movement in the spiritualism. There was the Golden Dawn with Crowley, Aleister Crowley, and I mean like dozens of them. He belonged to the Thule people, or at least followed them. And they were, for the most part, bankers and industrialists and people with a lot of money and a lot of power. And they had, let's say, prophecy in quotes, that they were going to find somebody who could lead the German people, somebody that had been anointed by their God, whatever that was. And this bookkeeper, looking at the information being put on the side of this book, made him realize that this guy that just came in might be him, the Messiah. So the next time that Adolf shows up, the bookkeeper manages to convince him that he has a destiny back in Germany. And he gets him to Germany under the guidance and money of the Thule organization. And that's the start of Adolf Hitler. I was watching this TV show on the Spirit of Destiny, and they said, you know, that, well, this is true, that once he became Chancellor of Germany, 3 days later, Hitler himself made a trip to Vienna in the Habsburg Museum. And he himself claimed the spear for his own purposes. They said, but it didn't work for him. They'd gone through the history and stuff, you know, because he lost the war. Well, that's not exactly true, because he was winning the war. Without a doubt, he was winning the war. And then he took the, it wasn't just the spear of destiny. They took all of the regalia of the Habsburg Empire with them, the crown, the scepter, all of the rich stuff. I mean, it was a treasure trove that he brought back to Germany. And eventually it was put in the, I think it was St. Catherine's, but it was in Nuremberg. It was a cathedral. And it was on display. And during the time that it was there and safe and everything, Hitler took one country after another country. And then he gets into Russia, and the German forces started getting bogged down. And somewhere in the same time frame, the first attack of American and British bombers flew into Germany, and the church was damaged. I don't know if it was a target, but it was definitely damaged. The Germans freaked out, and they took everything out of the church, and it disappeared. Nobody knew where it was. The story is that the mayor of Nuremberg was the one that was in charge of taking it and hiding it. And there's a little bit of history about that, but again, nobody really knows where it went. Then, after, from then on, he started losing. Okay. The Russians were able to get a toehold in what the Russians did, or Soviets at the time, they went and they took, as the Germans were attacking them, they took every piece of manufacturing capability that they had and could move, and they moved it beyond the Vogel River, which was a natural barrier for the Germans to get through. The city was called Stalingrad, that was like the last city to be fought for, right on the edge of the Vogel River. They took all of this stuff and they burnt all of the fields, so there was no food for the German army. It was a parched earth kind of thing. And the war continues, and there's a terrible battle and battle and battle all through Soviet Union, from Moscow to essentially Stalingrad. And then one day, all of a sudden, there were airplanes overhead, there were tanks coming at them, they were all being shot up, the Germans, because as the war was going on, the Soviets had rebuilt their factories and were creating weapons that the Germans didn't seem to have any idea was happening. And so the German army was surrounded, and I think it was thousands, I know it was thousands of them were captured. And that marked the beginning of the end for Adolf Hitler and the Nazis. The Soviets themselves actually destroyed more German divisions than the Allies did altogether, by, lots of them, and lots of them compared to what the Allies actually did. So you got this situation now where the spear has disappeared, it's not where it was. Everything starts going wrong. And there was this story about if a leader dropped the spear in battle, they would die shortly after that. So you end up having Normandy and, the Americans D-Day, and the Americans and the British and the French and the Spanish, everybody was coming closer and closer to Germany. And the fact is that the Germans had lost the war long before the Allies got to Berlin. Well, they didn't get to Berlin. The Soviets did. But it was one of those kind of death cults at that point. If Hitler wasn't going to survive and the Nazis weren't going to survive, they were going to take Germany down with it, with them. And then a group of American soldiers found an opening to a man-made cave, and at the back of the cave you have the vault, and all this treasure was inside it. They find it, and 2 hours later, Adolf Hitler supposedly committed suicide. That's the story behind the spear. But there's another story concerning that, and that was that George Patton, and he had the Seventh Army, I believe it was Seventh Army. He was a metaphysician. He knew an awful lot about it, but he would also be on different battlefields, and people that were with him would tell the stories. Guy's a little crazy. He thinks he fought here in another lifetime. But he would be able to relate details of battles that were fought, particularly in Africa. When they were over there in Africa, he had a lot of stories about different battles that were fought there. So I don't know what the depth of his beliefs were, but he definitely was, let's say, knowledgeable in this sort of thing. Well, some prisoners managed to escape from Germany. And somehow or another, these American prisoners knew about the Spear of Destiny. In being interrogated when they got back to Patton's lines by Patton's officers, intelligence officers, on what they saw, what they knew, trying to gather intelligence. They start talking about the Spear of Destiny. So now Patton hears about it and he looks at it and he goes, "Whoa, what is this?" So he contacts Churchill. And why he did that, I'm not sure, but he did. And so Churchill begins to believe that the Germans believe in the Spear of Destiny. And that if you want to break their control, maybe we should look for that Spear of Destiny and steal it. So Patton sets up a small group of people that their job was to go find the Spear of Destiny. And he never found it. It was the troops on the ground that found it. But he was the only one that went down there and looked at it. And like I've told you, he had this amazing experience when he saw it, in that the people that were there, the report, because it's a report that he was there, and that when he saw it, their interpretation was he was a little spellbound. But then he turned around and he said it's a fake. And my story about what happened was that it was the real one. But the energy of the spear was transferred into Patton's body. So when he walked out, it was the original spearhead, but it had lost its power. And he dies, and somehow or another, this energy is put into three crystals, which then become owned by me. So that when Gene Rockefeller, who knew nothing about the Spear of Destiny, calls me and says, "Jack says you've got to find these three crystals. They're holding the Spear of Destiny energy, and you've got to do it in 20 minutes." It was like, what the heck? But again, I had learned to listen to Gene and Jack, and maybe this is what happened. I don't know, but let's just go with it. And as soon as I read these three crystals, I saw the three crystals she was talking about in my head. So I went and I get the first two, and the third one I couldn't find. And I said, "If you want me to put this together, you better show me where this crystal is." And I get looking at this dome. It was a big glass dome like you'd see in a Frankenstein movie or something, that they'd use in laboratories for different experiments. And inside of it was the stone I was looking for, the crystal I was looking for. And it was a clear quartz. But every single stone in there I had put in there, and they were all amethyst, except this one. I wouldn't have done that. Why would I have done that? It was going to be all amethyst. So I put it together. I go outside to the Merkabah. I have an incredible experience out there that was just, it was darker than I've ever seen. I played a flute in ways I've never played it. I don't know what was happening, but something big was happening. And all of a sudden, the spear, which was a wand that Jack and Jean had sent me, it had the three of them on it. It kind of like exploded, and the three crystals went in different directions. And I hear this voice, "Never again." Flash forward to future time, current time, or at that time, current time. And I'm doing a radio show. Gene had sent me a piece of elite shungite. And I didn't realize it was wrapped up in a tissue, and I didn't even see it. I'd taken out whatever else she had in there, and I just thought the tissue was packing. But I was cleaning up the desk just before I was doing a radio show, cleaning up the desk, and I almost threw it out, and I said, wait a minute. And I was compelled to look in it, and I find this elite stone in there that's in the shape of a spearhead. And as I'm looking at it, I've got it in my palm of my hand, I'm looking at it, and all of a sudden it stood up straight and then levitated and then rotated. And I got the message, this is spear of d destiny energy in this stone. And that's what made me go to Ani and say, Ani, I got you, tell her the story. And she gets involved in it, and she's a trained shaman from her dad. It was a family thing out of Armenia. That family had been protecting the royal family for many generations. And the British intelligence group basically told her father, if you don't come with us and work for us and allow your first daughter, your first child to work for us, then we're going to kill you. And he chose to go to London and participate in British intelligence, which is what Ani was the first child, and that's what she was trained to do, not just as a shaman, but to work for British intelligence. And she did, she admits that she worked for the dark side. And finally, she started waking up to what was happening, what she was involved in, and she knew she couldn't do it anymore. And you really can't leave that role. But she somehow or another blackmailed one of the British intelligence people and was able to get herself out from underneath that. And she immediately, when she could, because she had to, get permission from the US government to come to America, she ended up coming to America. And she did nothing for like a decade in this field because she didn't, it was probably part of her, them allowing her to go. And I have questioned that. Why would they let her go? But she, this is her story. She's never gotten very deep into it. She makes references to it, and but she's the most knowledgeable. I don't doubt her because she's the most knowledgeable person I know about an incredible number of subjects that are kind of woo-woo subjects. So we go through this whole process, and it gets to the point where I've got to make a decision as to what I'm going to do with this spear of destiny and the energy. And I get permission through working with her and stuff to take the energy and then focus it so that every light worker has now access to the spear of destiny. No one person, but the good people in humanity, those people, they've got the power to make a change, the power to do good. Now, Ani will tell you that there was a tremendous amount of negative energy associated with this. I have no doubt about it. So why did I feel free thinking that this was a good idea to give the energy of the spirit of destiny to all these light workers? I mean, if it's black energy, if it's dark energy, why would I do that? People have asked me, how could the energy from the spear going to Patton, and then when he died, it'd be in these crystals. Think in terms of you got an electric plant, it puts out an electric signal, and then you charge your battery, and now the electric energy is in the battery. Transferring energy from one place to another is scientifically feasible. You can't destroy energy, but you can transfer it to something, and you can also alter it. The fact that I felt comfortable giving the energy of the Spear of Destiny and all of the potential it had for power to light workers was because once this energy went to the level of Gaia, the creator god of this planet, which is what I think happened when it exploded, and I heard never again. When it came back to me, it was inside, contained within Shungite, an elite Shungite, which is the purest form of Shungite. I had learned from Shungite many things. And one of those things is it could not do evil. Somebody who's got evil intentions will not find Shungite working for them. And I believed that the fact that it had come back that way meant that it was purified, that it was, let's say, now dedicated to good versus evil. That's why I think the Spear of Destiny is a real thing. So I'm going to leave this chapter because when we get into the next phase of it, the next chapter, it's going to be, let's say, a focus on good. What is good? What is this life of Wu reality taught me? So for now, I'm going to say thank you for listening. Appreciate you. We'll see you next time.
Say what? Say what radio show? With no agenda. It's always a surprise. But if we're not having fun, we're doing something wrong.